Jason Summer. Jason is here. Well, Jason, if you don't know, is a native of the Bronx, New York. Nobody from the Bronx here? All right, yes. He went to DeWitt C, L-I-N-T-O-N, DeWitt Clinton. That was our arch rival at George Washington, or one of them. His poems have appeared in many magazines, including River Styx, The New Republic, Tri-Quarterly, Chicago Review. For 7 years, from 1974 to 1981, he lived in Ireland, where he taught at University College in Dublin and did reviews for the Irish Independent. His English versions of Irish language poems, I guess that would be Gaelic, yeah, have appeared in several anthologies. He's received the Lyric Magazine's New England Prize and the Anna Davidson Rosenberg Award for poems on the Jewish experience, which is offered by the Judah L. Magnus Museum in Berkeley, California. We mentioned his collection of poems, Lifting the Stone, and Jason also has a more current collection that just was selected by the University of Chicago Press for their list, which is scheduled to, this book will appear in 1997, and it's called Other People's Troubles. Jason teaches at Literature and Creative Writing, as many of you know, at Fontbonne College. So it's always good to hear him, and I'd like you to make him feel at home here at Duff's. Jason Summer.
Competition removed. I'm going to read poems from the old collection and the new collection and poems uncollected, and I'm not telling you which. The first poem I'll read is, I'm always struck at, the first time I read at Duff's, I read with a musician, Bob Fishbone, who's also extremely alternative, did different kinds of, well, where's Bob? Oh, there he is. And it's what I feel also being in River Styx. I'm sort of the not only a small slice of multiculturalism for River Styx. I'm kind of the fag end of the tradition. I write poems that I'm the only rhymer in River Styx. And they're nice to accommodate me, and they accommodate me well. I'm happy to be here and grateful to that magazine. The first poem I'll read strikes me as my kind of Eastern Enlightenment poem, and it's called Amnesia. And it's about that moment waking up where you don't know who you are or what you are or where you are, not after a hard night. Amnesia. Wakening late, and the light blazed yellow through curtains and down through the pine floorboards, which led from the window to the rush bottom chair beside the bed. Not a Van Gogh yellow, for I had no Van Gogh anywhere in mind, nor even yellow. The lips formed by the creases in the sheet were not lips, creases, or sheet. Each thing surveyed nothing like anything else, yet everything itself exactly, though I had no idea of words. The stained glass light blinked several times, blinded by a rising or setting bird, as I can say now, but would have been just then unable to say, calmly unable even to recover my name or make the room my room or the body in the bed me, infant, Adam, clown, anyone who by definition did not know the use of anything and might bring sheet to mouth or paw at dust motes. As it happened, I only looked, my whole face feeling as if it were an open eye. For some minutes, whosoever I was breathing in the original light of awakening, from the belly like a singer, in quick as delight, and out, a slow stream which tumbled from sibilance to something like speech. And when I knew I had laughed, and thought of it as the call of a late dreamer under a sun high enough to reach over garden trees, no answer to anything else in creation he'd name, not the pluck of a nerve, but there in the voice as a kind of proof that beneath sad facts to come to say in time was a laugh like a given note of the earliest music of the animal who speaks and will remember. I by then had, of course, already long returned to myself. That's all the spiritual awakening I can do for this evening. The poem that I'll follow that with, for no other reason, but it's about Van Gogh, and I seldom read it. It's called Van Gogh's Boots, and it's taken from those series of Van Gogh's pictures of shoes and boots, variously named shoes or boots. And it has an epigraph from Van Gogh's letters, two little sections. When I got home, I was so angry that I threw the poor plaster casts in the coal bin, and they broke in pieces. And I thought, I will draw from casts only when there are no more hands and feet of living beings to draw from. I then said to Mauve, "Man, do not speak to me again about plaster, for I cannot stand it." Theo, I am decidedly not a landscape painter. When I shall make landscapes, there will always be something of the figure in them. Yeah, they're beautiful letters. Van Gogh's Boots. It's in several sections. One. My old, still serviceable shoes have moved me deeply, angled in conference, toe to toe, looking as self-opposed as one could wish of an emblem of the common life, till I resolved that they must sit for me, and I moved them, setting them side by side like brother boats anchored down by a quay. Yet for surface, I surround them only with the murky green of undersea, as in the focus of an excluding mind. For untied, they drift away, trailing their lines, one pair of which eddies into a sickle, a question, even in the stillness, as the left one floats, of whether the right may founder, half furled in the uppers, and sloped badly by the rough weather of my rolling gait, as if I always walked one foot in the furrow, one on the crest. Often on the plowed Dutch ground, they are splashes of black, like the browny black below, before the green to be brown, to be gold, to be bred of a wheat field under sun or crows, under the small and separate maelstroms of each star's swirling fingerprints. Two. Cast off me, life mask, shed skin I will put on again. Every ridge, headland, seam, footprinted. So much mine, they are mine no longer, but the boots of the Borinage miners with whom I tried evangelizing, tongue tied to the gospel. Still I saw their shoes. Later, their feverish skin, I mopped in fever. lolling tongues, at least 8 sets of blank eyes, the soul you cannot see, wearing through, and the heel. Because we live here too, we call these places after ourselves, and ourselves after these places. They, in the Borinage, live in the hollows of their faces, and as if the land held them in its cupped palm, an old man piet on a bare hill in winter, like the head of an old man with a tonsure of frost and the cloudy eyes of 2 small ponds, and on either end of his clenched fist is a winter tree, bare and forked. The dark clothes of the world I can bear better just now than its shining body. Submission kneels in the sagging knee of my breeches in a pool of themselves just out of the picture, fallen from the back of a rush-bottom chair. But these boots are resistance, chafing me to change and changing with me. The hilly upswell, the rocky bones bulb, I roof with a little light, granting a small triumph. For I know that what we clothe is the urge to nakedness, which presses up toward freedom, and these also are forms made of the struggle. In no particular order. I'm terrible with order. I had eventually to call in a friend, several friends, several times to order my books for me, because I don't know what the permutation of, you know, whatever, however number of poems, I set each one next to one another, you know, and it all made sense to me for a flashing instant, and then didn't anymore. So I'll just sort of respond. I was thinking of this poem because of all the poems that Jane read out of Dreams. And this is a poem that appeared in the local magazine Delmar some time ago. And it's called The Most I Took Back from a Dream. And it's kind of about the purposes of dreaming at the simplest level. In other ways, it's very deep. It's way too deep to explain. Real deep. The Most I Took Back from a Dream. The ghost sensations in the limb that's gone are by report the ordinary ones, though free variations come when we shed entire bodies in the sleeping bed. We seldom feel what we have never done. So when I tumbled from a nightmare roof, I woke before arriving at a truth not known, though losing what seemed consciousness before I struck the ground felt more or less familiar as the sudden downward route, which ended in an interregnum awake in bed before I fell again into a sleep. By morning, I had flown, swooping over a landscape of pocked stone in County Clare, first kited by the wind, sweeping me helpless from the burn to Moher and out to sea. I soon began to go where I inclined, downward after downcast eyes, but also looking upward, I would rise. How could I disbelieve it? I was there, aloft, approving Moher's precipice and Burren Rock for visionary practice, as if this were the place I would awaken, armed only with that skill which must be taken from dreams. I steered the spirit bodiless. Read an elegy now, which is in recognition of the spirit bodiless. This is for my grandfather, Meyer Kopp. Kopp is one of those Ellis Island names where the fellow who signed him in got tired of the long ending and said, no, this is, Kopp is a good name. Let's just end it right there. Elegy. It has kind of a chorus. It starts in italics. So imagine me saying italics. starts in a sort of different voice. And maybe there are a few things I should say about this, but maybe not. The side locks that are spoken of here are what a Hasidic Jew would wear, and still do. Nothing much else. It also is about forgetting and remembering. Elegy. Death dissolved you sweetly, grain by hourly grain, till all that was left was sweetness, till only your sweetness remained. For 80 years, buying time, you sent ahead what we all send, your hair, your teeth, the slender ends of fingernails, not minding the losses any more than when it was your dearest moments you offered to oblivion. As if the pages of an album in one final turning turned in the currents of a fire, gave up their scenes for burning, burned your mother's kitchen, the harness shop your father kept, head down his sidelocks swung to the hammer's tap, a choir of village children in a line, voices to whom you sing in answer, suddenly surrendering to the time the liveliest of dancers chose you at a landslide ball, remembered, remembering, forgetting then, forgetting all the passing things that anger was, releasing one by one to silence the words of several languages, the names you gave your children, whose tender child at last you were, taking less than you had been, therefore, away from them forever. Sweetly, grain by grain, till only your sweetness remained. Taking the note from that poem about children, I'll read poems variously inspired by my own children, two of whom are here, one of whom had something better to do. Who always has something better to do. This poem is called For My Daughter Concerning Beauty. I will not point her out, but she's the person receding into the wall at this very moment. And for some reason, I wrote this thinking I was speaking to her a long time ago, anticipating a time that is only really coming now. You know, fathers and daughters, it's an odd arrangement. Mm-hmm. For my daughter concerning beauty. There are still people living who will fall for statues. From Aphrodite, punishment for insufficient self-love that we imagine warm animation possible in those unmoved others whose noble foreheads clearly ought to house high thought, whose bright eyes seem made to speak. Love what's complete without you for a time, my daughter. You hate after. Still years ahead for her, I hope, I think. This, in a peculiar way, is for my son, Ben. Benjamin means, as you probably know, son of the right hand. Benjamin, of course, is like all my children, are lefties. And this poem, actually it arose out of an argument I was having with a fellow named Fred Moramarco, if you happen to come across him, who was always at me to stop writing fictions in poems, but write sincerely and from the heart. And I wrote this poem called A Left-Handed Man Wrote This. I am a righty, and I have taken various facts in my biography and sort of reversed them, made the true untrue and the untrue true, and passed it to Fred, who was deeply moved by the poem. And who never really forgave me for that, you know, the lesson in the power of fiction and the thinness of a page when it comes to reproducing an entire human soul. A left-handed man wrote this. Arched over a retrospective swan, my fist and wrist and arm do more than shadow cross the page. They shade it, going back on what I write and smearing. You would never know to read this crisp, square, immovable type, the wrong slant that I have on things, the low blow fate dealt, how left is victim of the right, how my own mother made into an error the way I held my spoon, how father would fight to force my throw, how saxophones and scissors opposed or were altered individually as orthopedic shoes. Oh, had I been a fencer, then those who looked in mirrors just to see themselves had better have found one to imagine like me, advantaged by unfamiliarity. If only we wrote as Hebrew still is written, in what clear track would come from my pen the code for sounds, if only my name weren't Benjamin. When Fred hit the Benjamin line, he thought maybe something was up. But sincerity is a blinding thing. This last child poem is for my son Matthias, the one who's not here. And it's called The Find, and recounts an incident out of his childhood. The Find. For days, all day, the sounds we could not place. Above us sometimes, sometimes underground, the smallest fragments of a newborn whale. No human baby nearby, a kitten somewhere lodged in the house's body we settled on and searched, straining at first to hear the cries, but then, now that we had the tune, we heard its faintest whispers. Even when we didn't, we felt that soon we would, and so we did, the first day and the second. The third day was mostly interval, and we reprised the rounds of everywhere we'd thought to look. No one more intent than you at going anywhere the sound appeared to lead. That summer, you'd begun to muster cool against intrusion, holding yourself apart from all of us, building over what you were, that sweetest, most forthcoming child in long muscle and silence. Offended when I kept you from the sloping wooden ladder to the roof, you brought a flashlight to the basement, stamping downstairs. You let your interest resume its technical expression, pleased at the sub and superstructure of the house, basement and attic, places of pipes and struts and wires, finding what offers and disguises access, hatches, grills, and gratings, inspecting vents and ducts. When night came, no one had heard the animal for hours, and I prepared us for defeat, wanting to hide this one mortality at least. I said what we thought weak cries within were stronger, but from outside and at a distance, that it had been rescued by its mother. Nobody was convinced. And then the slimmest filaments of call did lead outside, behind the house, under the long porch, which I probed with light. You took the flashlight and crawled in. We waited, our shins brushed occasionally by the beams, listening to the fricatives of crawl, the scrape and sweep, sent into flurries by more new pulses of beacon mewing, followed by another sound, the purest vocative, halfway between an oh and ah, high-pitched, descending, all trail and after sound, wind down and exhalation, stretching the time it took to say itself, to say you, since it was yours, was you, and is. You constant, ah, covert you, you heart's cry and answer, you for whom I didn't know I waited. Go in and I will wait for you again, always now. You emerging suddenly, steadily with the bundled life riding on your palm, already something muted in your pride. I'll switch gears a little bit now, and I'll read one more kid poem, sort of a kid poem, but kind of a visionary kid poem. This is called Islanded with Children, and it's also a dream poem. Kind of imagines and it imagines generation and the unfolding of time and the disappearance of heritage, which can be, you know, as a double-edged kind of a thing. John Lennon, you know, imagine there's no heaven. And all the benefits that accrue from that. Islanded with children. I dreamt a palimpsest of beach, written on and waved clear, a place I stand and teach from memory a Hebrew prayer. Islanded with sons and daughter, we are escaped alone, sole remnant of a slaughter, till other children come from islands of their own. Left out of creation only in a late account, across the fringe of tide, two by two at first, but numbers do not mount. Some leave as more arrive. The children chorus like the surf. Song raggedly begun ends in a partial unison and starts again. My daughter rocks, repeating the notes I substituted, the words I used instead of those that I forgot, to others who teach others to their left the chanted song, in which I just discern my errors before the singing changes further, my own part almost gone, the children almost strangers, until the first one comes who is, who only knows the sounds he hears are sounds of prayer or were. I'll read just a couple more sections. This is the title poem of, it's really not such a big shift as the occasion for imagining that kind of vanishing is a sort of a post-Holocaust imagination. And I'll read you the title poem of the new book and a couple of sections out of a poem called Mengele Shitting, which follows it, which I'll explain something of. Now, no prizes for guessing that the title poem of the new book is in the new book. I know I said I wouldn't tell you, but, you know. I found myself... my first book does a lot of work with my father's story. He's a survivor. And I found myself changing the character of my own dealings with the Holocaust by dealing with my aunt's story, which, and the whole idea of the difference between the way women remember and create experience in the way men do, render experience. This is called Other People's Troubles, and it's in three sections, small sections, and I'll pause it at each of them. And it runs through the same thing three times, really, in different sort of modes. The first is a kind of no place, no time, parable space. The second is kind of a contemporary circumstance. And the third is a documentary of World War II memory. Other People's Troubles. The Jewish parable goes that in the waiting room where all souls come, They leave a bundle of their troubles on hooks. At their return, emerging from interviews, they eye the parcels hung in hundreds on the walls with care and take their own. Trash night, curbside sits a little sofa meant for the taking. No one around even to see our need. A few speculatable stains, though in the abstract forest on its cover, shadows turn out not to be impeded streetlight, but the body's unguent, armrests oiled by arms. We leave the sofa there, sturdy and recoverable, life in it yet. Lily said that on the rim of Birkenau, before the women heard the name or saw the chimneys' fires and long shadows of ash, but after stripping, herding, shearing, searching, the unhinged laughter at this, the only nakedness of its kind in their lives, a minute of dribbled shower, the slap of disinfectant, scalp, crotch, and underarms, the mad clothes thrown at them without regard for fit, rag remnants of gowns, tattered cocktail dresses, satin, tulle, and crepe put on, more laughter then. Who are these scarecrows who are us? But not one of them. The heavy woman choked inside the sheath skirt, with the slender girl tenting in a gown with a train. Not the tall woman bound in the arms of the short dress, pulling it down to cover her thighs, with the small woman hiking up folds. No one would trade with anyone. Just a couple more sections, and that's enough. This is from Mengele Shitting. It's a long poem. I'll read you another sort of Lily segment of it. And the premise of the poem is that I'm trying to bring a gift to these survivors, various kinds of gift. One in this poem is the gift of being able to locate a time when someone died so that proper ceremonial remembrance can take place. And I think I can do that with research. And the overarching idea behind the poem is that there's a story that I have learned that I can give my aunt about the monster Mengele, the all-too-human monster, about what happened to him after the war. I'll just read you this section, though. It's called Speaking of the Lost. I cannot look at Lily as I ask my father about his younger brother Shmuel, whom she knew only a little, the brother also of her husband Harry sitting on my left. Of these survivors of slave labor and war, her history may be the worst, and she never speaks of it, not of Auschwitz or the brothers of her own she lost there. So it's her eyes I avoid as I break the etiquette forbidding anyone to ask for speech when speech is memory and memory is pain. Alone among them, I try to think of myself as an adult with a right to speak, a man who has paid a price and waited long enough, and I have children of my own off somewhere in the house with their mother and my mother, but I feel like a child demanding a story, teased with the half promise of my father's stories, wanting the one he cannot tell, the one which has been told to him by witnesses in that vague way they have of passing on essentials only, the barest news. I want whatever else can be recovered to hold Shmuel at the center of a final scene, but Harry and my father have begun now with the boyhood of someone who is already the hero of a tale. Handsome as he was tall, as strong as he was both, at home in the forests around Kustanovice, gifted with understanding the language of animals. And I continue the romance to the end, imagining him a wild creature, gnawing his very life away to be free of the trap, undoing the web of barbed wire over the window of not a cattle car I knew already, a Karlsruhe freight, 100 tons, a number chalked up outside on the weathered boards, forcing himself out awkwardly, dropping, how far down, to the water. If they suffer memory for me, maybe I can give them something in return, the date they need to commemorate the true anniversary of Shmuel's death with yardside candles, my bookishness of use to them with SS diaries, maps of train routes. As they grow older, more and more they want the ritual. I want the discipline of facts about that train to Auschwitz, to anchor Shmuel in the drift of others' memory, where he swims across an unnamed river to his death in a flood of gunfire on the farther shore. I have a plan to follow rivers, if only on the maps, until they intersect the lines of track, and I will have the place he died among those crossings. How many trestle bridges can there be, crossing as the rivers bend? I run to get an ordinary atlas, which shows the possibilities in blue meandering lines and red lettering, the Tisa, too soon out of Munkacs, or the Latorcha, Laborec, Ondava, Topla, Torisa, as if I could name a river to go back along against the current of forgetting. Nervous, I talk and talk, babbling over the map of Eastern Europe between us on the table, how, rate by time equaling distance, the date must lead to the place, but either will give the other. How at first I thought that it was winter, filling in with images from movies, the shot man tumbling down the incline of the tracks or rolling into the snow. May, Lily says abruptly, May, between the 22nd and the 24th, 3 days, 2 nights to Auschwitz from the station at the brickworks. She was on the transport. She was there. Nobody looks stunned that she has harbored this for more than 40 years. No voice but mine determined to recover Shmuel, to rescue the hero from her silence. How could she have kept it all these years? Lily, there was shooting. The train was halted on a trestle bridge. Think the 22nd, the 23rd, day or night. Brakes shrieking, Polizei shouting in German, the splashing below in the water. Surely she would recall which day that was. No, says Lily mildly. There was shooting many times. Many times the train would stop without a reason. In our car, everyone, old people and children, pressed together. The women held rags out of the window to catch the rainwater we could drink. The train had many cars. No one thing happened I could tell from where I was. Thank you.